Well, friends, today we're looking at our fourth section in Ecclesiastes, and today we'll hear again from the preacher in Ecclesiastes as he continues his search for the meaning of life in this life under the sun. Life in the here and now, in this physical world that we can see and touch and taste and smell. As he looks at this life viewed from his secular standpoint, of course, he's not an atheist. He does believe in God, but he just doesn't believe God's very involved in the world. He's pretty much like many people in our world today. And friends, we've already seen previously his conclusion about life under the sun, about life lived from a completely secular standpoint. He's already concluded that everything is meaningless or pointless, that it's a vanity or a chasing after the wind. And today we find the preacher examining justice or injustice and oppression. And they're big issues in his world and big issues in ours. Friends, you and I live in a society built on the rule of law. The rule of law exists to protect individuals from the state and to protect us from one another. And the rule of law protects our freedoms and spells out our responsibilities. So we have lawmakers, we have governments and parliaments, and we have law enforcers, we have the police, and we have law interpreters, the judges and the magistrates. And the centre of law is the idea of justice, doing what's right and good. And of course, we like to think of justice as being impartial, that if we have to go to court, we'll be treated fairly, irrespective of whether we're rich or poor, or whether we're born in Australia or overseas, and independent of our political views. But friends, in the real world, unfortunately, there sometimes is corruption in those institutions which are supposed to give justice. And history tells us this. Sometimes lawmakers and law enforcers are corrupt. They can be bought off by powerful people, say by criminals. So a classic case was in Chicago in the 1920s when the infamous bootlegger and mobster Al Capone was at his height. So Capone paid off the politician, the mayor. He paid off sections of the police force. So evil at the hand of Capone flourished because those sworn to uphold justice were corrupt. Friends, corruption amongst those who should uphold justice does happen. And it happens even in Australia. So over the months and years, here in Australia, we've had instances of corrupt police, of corrupt politicians, of corrupt people in our legal system. We may like to think we live with legal institutions which are rock solid, that we can absolutely put our faith in, but sadly, there have been enough instances of corruption in our legal system and in our law enforcement system and amongst our politicians, enough corruption to make us at least a bit sceptical. But friends, if we can't be sure of justice in this world, in our systems, what can we be sure of? In fact, it's a really depressing thought if you think about it for too long. And friends, in chapter 3, verse 16, the preacher, he's looking at life under the sun, and he's thinking about the legal institutions of his day. And he sees, in verse 16, wickedness in the place of justice, and wickedness in the place of righteousness. He observes that the law courts and the civic institutions, which are sworn to uphold justice, to uphold that which is good, he sees that there's wickedness there. Those who should be dispensing justice don't do it. Those who should receive justice don't get it because the judges and officials are corrupt, taking bribes perhaps, or showing favouritism and playing fast and loose with the truth. And friends, this distresses the preacher as it would distress us. The one place where we expect to find justice is within our legal institutions, in the courts. Especially if we have to go to court, we expect to get justice. Justice is supposed to be blind. Whether you're rich or poor, whether you're famous or a so-called little person, you should get justice in the courts. But is that always the case? Well, maybe it's not. You see, the richest people hire the most expensive and smartest lawyers, and the smartest lawyers mount the best arguments, and the best arguments often decide the case. Friends, we'd like to think that those who act corruptly instead of promoting justice, we'd like to think that those corrupt people would get what's coming to them, that they won't get off scot-free. And so the preacher, who's observed this corruption, this wickedness in the place of justice, the preacher tries to console himself with the thought that they won't get away with it in verse 17. He says, both the righteous and the wicked will be judged by God. So he tries to reassure himself that justice is coming, that corrupt politicians and corrupt officials, they'll get what's coming to them. That's what he'd like to think, or what he'd like to believe. But then in verse 18, we see that he's not actually sure. He's not 100% sure. He thinks out loud, what if God will not judge? What if the powerful and the corrupt live out the whole of their lives in ease and plenty and above the law, and then they just die? What if they never get their day in court? He says they'll be no worse off than the righteous, no worse off than those who've always lived according to society's laws. Because the preacher sees that they all die, the wicked and the righteous. And when the wicked die, well, it's too late. Apparently, they'll have gotten away with it. Because he says in verse 19 and 20, the preacher observes that under the sun, people die just like animals die. So in that sense, mankind, despite being so advanced compared to the animal kingdom, in that sense, mankind's no better off than the animals. He says in verse 20, they all go to the same place. That is, they go to the grave where they decay. And the preacher here just frankly doesn't know what happens afterwards. In the end, he's really unsure whether God will judge beyond the grave. He says he can't be sure whether the breath or spirit of man goes up, whether it goes up to face God in judgment or not. And so here, friends, the issue of whether justice will eventually be carried out is actually left painfully unresolved by the preacher. Like us, he'd love to see justice done. He'd love to see those who act corruptly brought to justice. But if that doesn't happen in this life under the sun, then he's just not sure if it'll happen beyond the grave. So he decides in verse 22, well, we can't sort out the big issues of life, the ultimate issues of justice in this world, so we may as well all just settle down and enjoy what we can be sure of, what we can trust. So he says, verse 22, it's therefore good to enjoy our work. In fact, to receive enjoyment from our work here under the sun, that's our lot, or actually that's our modest, simple reward. So the sense here is, let's not bother our heads about corruption and injustice. We can't fix it anyway, so let's not bother. But then, of course, it's not quite that simple, is it? Because when there's institutionalized injustice and corruption, it lends power to the ruthless, and the powerful ruthless oppress people, and the oppressed suffer. And so in verse 1 of chapter 4, the preacher sees the tears of the oppressed, and it distresses him. He's appalled that there's no one to comfort them, to assist them. There's no one to dry their tears. He says, again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. And friends, human history is actually full of the tears of the oppressed. So if you think of the slave trade in the New World in the 16th to 18th centuries, there were human beings stolen from Africa, stolen from family and home, transported in shocking conditions to the New World and set to hard labour like pack horses. All power was on the side of the oppressors. So the law of America and England supported that slave trade. The law supported the oppression and the enslavement of human beings. The powerful oppressors had free rein, and the oppressed were left all alone in their tears, with no one to comfort them. And friends, in our day, there's still so much that's wrong. There's so much oppression and so many tears. So just ask the kidnapped schoolgirls in Nigeria, or the Christians and other minorities being slaughtered in the so-called Islamic State, or the so-called guest workers from Bangladesh and other places stuck in the factories and the building sites of Dubai, far away from family, earning a pittance. And friends, here, all the oppression the preacher sees absolutely appalls him. In fact, he wishes he'd never, never become aware of it. He wishes he'd never seen it. He says, even in verse 2, he thinks it would be better, he would be better off to be dead. He says, "And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive." He thinks, well, at least if he was dead, then he wouldn't have to see all the oppression anymore. So imagine that, being so appalled by oppression that you wish you were dead so you didn't have to see it anymore. Or even, verse 3, never having been born so you never had to see any oppression ever. He's so distressed by the oppression of the oppressed. But friends, it's worth asking the question, what causes oppression? Well, one powerful factor has always been the desire for wealth on a corporate level or a national level, but also, sadly, on a personal level. We see that from verse 4. So oppression, driven by the desire for wealth, it's often driven by envy, by wanting what our neighbours have, by trying to keep up with the Joneses or perhaps go one step better. And so the preacher provocatively says in verse 4 that all toil and all skill, or actually all success in work, springs from envy. It springs from envy of our neighbour. But he says it's actually pointless. It's like chasing the wind. It's pointless because even if we get fabulously rich, we'll still die. And even if we've amassed a huge fortune compared to our neighbour, when he and we are both lying in our graves, we'll be no better off than him. Because death is the ultimate leveller. Of course, the preacher doesn't advocate being lazy. He says in verse 5, it's foolish. If you're so lazy that you're always folding your hands and never working, you will end up starving and poor. But he concludes, rather than striving after wealth based on envy of your neighbour, and rather than being lazy and a fool, he says better than both these is to work for what you legitimately need in verse 6. He says, better is a handful of quietness, working for what you need, than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. That is, rather than striving and wearing yourself out, seeking to get rich. Because seeking to get rich never does anyone good in the long run. So I wonder if you've actually seen a movie called The Family Man. It starred Nick Cage. And in the movie, the main character, Jack Campbell, he was a ruthless, high-flying business executive. He had the fast cars and the superb city apartment. He had all the luxury. He had everything that money can buy. But in the movie, he's absolutely alone. He has no relationships, except for the women that he uses, or the employees that he abuses. He has no family and no friends. He's unbelievably wealthy, but he's actually completely impoverished. He's madly chased money all his life, and now he's got everything, but nothing. In fact, it's because he's so madly chased money that, relationally speaking, he's a pauper. And friends, we meet someone just like Jack Campbell in chapter 4, verse 7. Here, this person, he's working all the time. There's no end to his toil. He's married to the job. And even as he's getting richer, his eyes are never satisfied with his riches. So he keeps going, he keeps slogging, he keeps chasing the almighty dollar, but he's not developing any real relationships. He's not sustaining any relationships. He's far too busy making money to do that. This man is madly addicted to his work and chasing money. And we read in verse 8, he says, his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never stops to ask, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. He never stops to ask, what the heck am I doing? I'm busting my gut. I've got no leisure time. I'm wearing myself out getting rich. And I've got no one, absolutely no one, to share my wealth and my time with. And it's pointless and it's meaningless. This bloke is so wrapped up in his work that he cannot see it. So busy chasing an individualistic dream that he cannot see the madness he's ensnared in. He's become a mad individualist materialist, and his humanity, frankly, is being damaged in the process. So friends, this man is not someone we should aspire to be. You see, friends, as human beings, we've been made for relationships and community with other human beings. Friends, human beings are infinitely more valuable than money and stuff and materialism. But more than that, there's practical benefit to relationships. And so he goes on, the preacher, from verse 9 to show how much better relationships are compared to individualism. So if life's like a journey, it's much better to have company on the way than to go it alone. So verse 9 tells us, two are better than one. And verse 10, if you fall over, it's good to have someone to help you up rather than being on your own. Or verse 11, if the night is cold and you're trying to keep warm, perhaps especially if you're out bush, it's good to have someone to help you keep warm. So that's why they say if you're lost in the bush at night, firstly, you stay where you are, you don't wander off, but secondly, you huddle close together to stay warm. And verse 12, if you're travelling, especially back in those days, if you're attacked, well, it's much better to have two of you than to be alone. So if you go walking around the streets late at night, it's safer to go with someone else. Friends, as the preacher says here, two are definitely better than one. Companionship is definitely better than isolated individualism. But if two is better than one, then three is much better again, verse 12. We're told a threefold cord is not quickly broken. And here, friends, the word three, it's actually symbolic of many. The thought here is of a multitude of people all supporting one another, all looking out for one another. Friends, it's a bit like what I saw on the news recently. Shamefully, there was some man who's been attacking lone women in the western suburbs of Melbourne while they're out exercising. So a group of local women thought, well, we want to exercise, we want to do it in the fresh air, and we want to be safe. So they banded together to make this exercise group, and there was 15 or more of them. So their life, including their exercise life, has now become safer and richer because they exercise together rather than alone. They're enjoying safe exercise together rather than anxious exercise alone. Friends, from this passage we see that community is important. It's good for us. It's good for the well-being, our well-being in society. In community we can look out for one another and we can assist one another, especially in times that are tough. And of course the community in the church is important. In fact, the church is God's new community. Friends, here in the church, in this local church or any local church, we're to look out for one another, for one another's welfare, including our spiritual welfare. We're to encourage one another to keep persevering in trusting Jesus. Yes, community is better than individualism. Two are better than one. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. But from verse 13, we see that under the sun, even community is flawed. Civic life is flawed. Societal life is flawed. So in verse 13 to 16, we find the fickleness of political civic life. Political leaders, in this case kings, come and maybe they start out okay, and maybe they listen to the people, to the community for a while. Maybe they're popular with those they represent for a while. They look out for the well-being of the community. But then they seem to stop listening. In a sense, like the king, the foolish old king in verse 13, they become old and foolish. They stop listening. And so they're replaced, perhaps by someone younger, like the young wise king, someone who enjoys the confidence of the community, at least for a while. But then again, in this life under the sun, the community or the electorate tires of that leader too. And we've seen that repeatedly in our own lifetime, I'm sure, with political leaders and governments that come, perhaps enjoy a honeymoon period for a while, and then we can't wait to be rid of them. And this, friends, under the sun, is also meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Well, friends, in today's passage, I think you'll agree with me that the preacher's looked at some live issues in his day and in ours. He's looked at the corruption of justice, the ruthless oppression of the powerless by the powerful, the desire for money that often drives that oppression. He's looked at the fact that we are more than individuals. Friends, we're not made to exploit or oppress one another as human beings, but to live in mutually supportive community. And friends, we've seen that the preacher is hopeful that those who perpetrate injustice will be judged. The powerful who oppress the weak will be judged. If not in this life, under the sun, then perhaps in the next. But we've also seen that he's not at all sure. After all, it seems that under the sun, the end of humans is just like that of the animals. They both end in the grave. And he doesn't know what happens next. Perhaps he thinks God will judge, but he can't be sure. And the preacher, frankly, is disturbed by the prospect that the corrupt and the oppressors might just get away with all the evil they've done under the sun. But friends, is that what really happens? At the end of the day, will there be no justice? Well, not quite. So look with me at Psalm 49, which Bruce read to us. Now, the writer of the psalm knows just a bit more than the preacher of Ecclesiastes. He knows that indeed there is more to be said than just what happens under the sun. The psalmist agrees that the powerful who arrogantly oppress the weak will indeed perish like the beasts. So we see that in verse 12 and in verse 20. But the psalmist knows that's not the final word. The psalmist says that afterwards they will indeed be judged by God. The psalmist is certain of it. They'll be judged forever. In the pit, verse 9, or in Sheol, verse 14. But the psalmist also knows that those who humbly trust in God will be ransomed or rescued in the next life, verse 15. They'll be with God forever. So the preacher in Ecclesiastes was not sure whether the fate beyond death was any different for the righteous, those who trust in God, than for corrupt oppressors. But friends, Psalm 49 assures us that God will ransom those who humbly trust in him, all who humbly trust in him. But how does the ransom take place? How does this rescue take place? Well, Psalm 49 even, it doesn't tell us. But fortunately, the New Testament does. So if you look with me at 1 Timothy 2, verse 5 and 6. There we read, "For there is one God, and there is one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus, who gave himself up as a ransom for all, which is the testimony given at the proper time." So here, friends, we see that Jesus is the one who ransoms those who trust in him. Jesus rescues us. Jesus is the one who mediates between us and God, who makes peace between us and God. You see, friends, none of us naturally loves God as we should. None of us obeys God as we should. So even though none of us is an Al Capone or a corrupt official, we all naturally incur God's judgment. But friends, we can dodge that judgment that's certainly coming. We can dodge that by trusting in Jesus. Friends, Jesus came as a ransom for us from God's judgment, to rescue us from judgment. Friends, you and I are indeed more than just beasts which perish. We're people made in God's image, people who make real moral choices. Sometimes we choose right, but often we choose wrong. We fail to live as the image bearers of God that we should be. And the Bible calls that sin, and after death God will judge. But friends, know this, that God's judgment for our sin need not fall on us personally. It need not mean our eternal ruin. Because, friends, Jesus paid a ransom for the sins of all who trust in him. Jesus will rescue all who trust in him. And, friends, Jesus can ransom you. He can ransom you from eternal death, and he can give you eternal life with God. So, friend, my question to you now is, are you now trusting in Jesus for forgiveness of sin so that you are ransomed from eternal death? Friend, will you trust in Jesus now for forgiveness of your sin so that you will be ransomed from eternal death? Let's pray about these things now.